This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Welcome and hello, everybody. This is Michael Shaw, and this is episode 298 with Doug Bube. He is an artist and a landlord and an Airbnb host in Brooklyn, New York. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Doug's and perhaps his brownstone in Brooklyn. First, I want to tell you about this podcast that I have been listening to. It's called Wireframe, and it is all about creativity, which we talk about in this show, and design. Now, if you listen to the podcast 99% Invisible, which I know some of you do, you will be into Wireframe. It's really a show that anybody who has any kind of interest in design and user experience and how that design impacts our world. I highly recommend you go listen to the one where they start talking about whether or not you should save your iPhone box. I don't have an iPhone box because I don't have an iPhone. But then evolves into an investigation into the art of designing environmentally friendly packaging, something that I, as an aggressive recycler, really appreciate. Look for Wireframe on whatever podcast app you use. They're on every one of them. We will also include a link in the show notes. Please go check this show out. By doing so, you will be directly supporting the conversation. Thank you in advance, and thank you very much to Wireframe for their support. All right, so brief description to get you enticed for this conversation. Doug talks about emigrating from Canada, for outside Toronto, to the U.S., and why he did so back in the day. He started training in traditional black and white photography under Minor White, the photographer Minor White in particular, and then eventually started doing freelance work as a photographer to pay the bills, but eventually went on to make what is referred to as book work, in his case, essentially making sculptures out of books in various ways. And we also talk about him being a small landlord as a form of financial stability, and even a little bit about his being an Airbnb host within that same brownstone. So that's coming up in a second. Just for a moment, want to thank those of you who support the podcast on Patreon. Thank you very much to all of you regular supporters. Let me know if I can do anything for you. If you like this show and want to show your support, the best way to do so is go to theconversationpod.com/support. And there are many ways you can support us financially, whether it's through PayPal, Venmo, or old-fashioned check, and certainly Patreon. You can support us there for as little as a dollar a month, though it's much appreciated, those of you who are supporting the show for $5, even $10 a month. And of course, you can support the show non-financially by leaving a great review on Apple Podcasts and or following us at Artist Podcast or me, Michael Shaw Art, on Instagram. And also, if those of you who are interested in my work and would like to continue to find out what I'm up to, go to michaelshawstudio.com. At the bottom of the page there, you can sign up for the newsletter, which I will not bombard you with. It's more like, you know, a couple of updates a year kind of thing. And it would be great to have you on that list. So thank you in advance. Thank you very much to Allie Widows for all she does to keep the show going. And if you are curious or interested in our Conversation 2.0, the new iteration of the podcast that we are working on as a group, which is going to be scripted stories about interesting people and events from contemporary art's past, feel free to reach out. Hopefully that will be coming up, not by episode 300, but hopefully soon enough. So keep you posted on that. Hope you guys are doing well. Happy summer. Happy winter to those of you in the Southern Hemisphere. And hope you're staying safe. Got to keep saying that, ultimately. We've got a new variant going around here. So masks again, apparently, in some cases indoors, that is called for. So there you go. Thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you again probably in a couple of weeks. Until then, ciao for now. All right, so Doug, you're in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And you've been there for quite a while. And I feel like we could talk about that, but maybe I was thinking maybe we could talk about it a little bit later. And first sort of set up what happened before you got there. So you're originally from Canada, from outside Toronto, right? What made you want to go to the States? Is it as I would guess, like a combination of reasons, or is it fairly straightforward?
I had family that was from the States, and every time I visited them in Detroit, even New York, where my uncle from my father's side was, let's say, the dean of dentistry at Columbia University, there was always an excitement about coming to New York. There was always an excitement going to Detroit. I just felt there was a buzz about it. Mm-hmm. And then when I was at York University, a number of my friends were from the States, and I hung out with them, and then I realized that there is a sensibility about them that was just full of inspiration, an intellectual capacity to express themselves, vivaciousness, spontaneity, and they were fun. They were just a lot of fun. Not that my Canadian friends weren't like that, but I was just drawn to that. And also a big influence was one of my best friends at the time, 1970, we were both in the film school. I was taking photography, but he was taking almost exclusively film. And he was from Washington, D.C. and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and we became inseparable.
Why?
So that was...
Yeah, but why do you think it was that all these people from the States were so interesting? I mean, that's not a national thing, right? Was that just a coincidence, or was it compared to who you were hanging out with in Canada, or what was that about, do you think, in retrospect?
Yeah, in Canada, we also had books that we read, I remember, about how we felt as secondary citizens to the United States in that sense, because the U.S. was always on the forefront of industry, science, and art. And I think being so close in Canada was not as established as it is today in those areas, especially in comedy and especially in art. So we looked to the States, and I did as well. I really felt that that was the mecca of art, and that's what drew me there rather than staying in Canada.
Right.
I think today, if I was starting out, I probably wouldn't have to go to the States. I feel all you need today is Wi-Fi and an internet, and you can literally be anywhere in Canada, and for that matter, anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we could spend all day talking about your story getting to the States and establishing a green card and things like that. But what maybe are some of the bigger points that come to mind, you know, along that journey? I mean, you just kind of outlined why you wanted to be there. So that seems to be the premise or the conceit for why you were willing to jump through so many hoops to get a green card, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, not only my relatives, but my friends were a draw. And then in 1974, I applied for a Canada Council and an Ontario Arts Council grant to photograph a U.S. circus. I had been photographing circuses, I think primarily all from the States, and I had this compelling notion of traveling with the circus. It's like running away with the circus, but not as a performer, but as a photographer. So I went to the States, and I was traveling northeastern United States from, I think, 1975 with this one show called Circus Kirk. And it was there that I spent 2 months on the show. When I came back, I went to a Pyron, that's a Aperon or a Pyron photography school. And it was there that I met Stuart Ashman. And Stuart told me about this photographer. His name was Minor White. And he said that Minor always accepts interns or people to work for him. And Stuart eventually became the director of one of the premiers of the New Mexico Art and Monuments, appointed by Richardson years ago. So he ended up being not only a photographer, but administrator. But back then, he was so encouraging. He said, oh, you would really appreciate Minor, whose work I didn't know at the time. And maybe I had seen in photography books. So I actually wrote Minor, and I said that I would like to, after I travel with the circus, to come down and take classes with you. So it was there that Minor, I did get down there. There's a whole other story, which we won't go into, where I met Nathan Lyons on the way down and went to his school. But Minor essentially offered me a position there to work with him. And he was paying me, I think, $100 a week plus room and board. And I would print with him in the dark room. I would do the chores, et cetera. So it was a type of apprenticeship or internship until the time he passed away. And once I got hooked into seeing the art galleries there, talking with people there, I really felt that I did not want to go back to Canada. I felt that at this point, my introduction to the States was deepening. And then from there, I went to and started a photography program at the Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa.
Right. Before we get into that part of your story, where was it specifically that you were apprenticing with Minor White?
So with Minor, I was in Arlington, Massachusetts. Huh. And that's how I ended there for the last year of his life.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you were getting this great education, obviously, and you were getting paid to do it. But you weren't in a particularly New York-like environment at the same time, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I think, again, it was just an environment of being in the environment of art as a primary medium for me that I grew up with. My father started me off when I was about 5 years old in the darkroom. We had our own darkroom at home. So to see someone like Minor who was working full-time as a photographer was really my goal.
Right.
And I met other photographers as well. Now, before I ended up there, Minor offered me the position. I went back to Canada, and I talked to a friend of mine who had studied with Harry Callahan and Aaron Siskin. And he was also an inspiration and a mentor to me. His name was Robbie Gubler. And I said to Robbie that Minor had offered me the position, but I wanted to go to graduate school. And Robbie was very wise. He was several years older than me. And he said, Doug, you can always go to graduate school, but you can never always work for Minor White. And that clinched it for me. I realized that I said, he's right. So that's why I accepted the position when Minor offered it to me.
Right.
So that's how I ended up there.
Got it. So you went from the circus to Minor White to the Maharishi Institute, right?
In fact, it's a little different, as I didn't explain it properly. I, after undergraduate work, then I traveled with the circus. And that was when I traveled with them for 2 months. I came back to Canada. And then that's when I started to explore the possibility of graduate school and then Minor. And then when I came back from visiting Minor, and that's when I decided to postpone graduate school. And I had already traveled with the circus. And Minor offered me a place to develop my series of photographs. And he was extremely generous. I mean, he didn't really know me from Adam. And he brought me in under his wing. There was one other photographer who was working there as well. So I felt Minor was just extremely generous to have someone that he, you know, back then you don't check your references.
Mm.
So that's how it started. And that's why I felt this was an opportunity for me that I didn't want to miss. And I'm very glad that I did continue with that possibility.
Yeah. So why don't you talk, you want to talk now about the Institute that you basically became a photographer in residence, right?
Yeah. So what happened was I was working on my circus portfolio. And I'd been meditating for about 5 years, and I knew that I wanted to continue both. I saw it in Minor that he really integrated his life as a spiritual individual as well as his photography. And that was my inclination. How could I combine these two very deeply influencing forces on my personal life and my photography? So I had called up the Maharishi International University, which is now known as the Maharishi University of Management. And literally, they were in a meeting, and they were deciding, deliberating right there about a photography teacher. And I told them who I was working for. I sent them my work. They said, send the actual work, a portfolio, which is, of course, what we don't do today. We send it a website or slides back then. And they held off for a week, and they called me back, and they said, we want to offer you the position. And that's essentially how I ended up there. And I started the photography program. It was a traditional photography program. It wasn't really experimental on the level of what we might call abstract photography, because my training was basically as a social documentary photographer. So that's how it started. And I was there for three years, I think.
Hmm. Now, were you were interested in that kind of meditation, right? So was it, did you get to take advantage of whatever they were offering as far as meditation training as well?
I had started Transcendental Meditation in 1970. And again, I was never someone to proselytize about it. I just knew that it was something that I thoroughly enjoyed. It gave me deep relaxation, and it gave me the energy level that I think I still have today, where I can do what I need to do. When I was there, I deepened the sort of the intellectual side of it, why I was doing it, how I understood the potential, that there was an endless potential for it, and meeting, you know, like-minded people. So that's why I continued there. Otherwise, I would have left. Mm-hmm. So the inspiration in photography was only now as an undergraduate, was I knew that I needed to go to graduate school to deepen my study. When I was in Toronto, I studied primarily with a well-known Canadian photographer, Michael Cimak. And Michael brought me from 1970 to 74. But during that time, I met another great photographer, David Heath. And David was an American who immigrated to Canada. And David was very influential in my trying to get a master's of fine arts, because I knew that was like getting a two-year grant or three-year grant so I could just do my photography. So there's, it's not like a trajectory which is just singular, but it's this, these interweaving individuals that I met in photography that propelled me to, both Americans and Canadians, that propelled me to really want to explore this notion of being a full-time photographer. So after MIU, I became a TM teacher. I didn't teach very much, but it was still important to my spiritual and personal development. Then I realized that I could go to graduate school. And it was from graduate school that at the Visual Studies Workshop in Rochester, New York, that I got my master's. And then I thought I was going to teach full time. Now, to make money for graduate school, I became a logger. I did cedar salvage in British Columbia. So it was important to me to make the money in order for me to reach my dream, which was to really study and train in photography. I was a natural photographer. But when I see people who have been trained in photography, I could see my friend Robbie Gubler was an exceptional photographer. And there are people who he influenced today that are international photographers. But anyway, so that's what drew me to the States, drew me to getting my degree, and then ending up in New York City, because there was the opportunity of continuing to be a photographer.
Why?
That's all.
Let me back up. What in your trajectory there? Why did you end up doing logging as a way to earn income on the other end of the country or other end of the continent, when it seemed like there could have been other options?
I'm used to physical labor, and I had worked in construction and road construction when I was a teenager, not as a full-time employee, but as a part-time. Those were my summer jobs. So I was quite used to physical work. There was an opportunity in Ucluelet, British Columbia, which is on Vancouver Island, that there was a group of individuals who I knew. And when I heard of this, I had to make a lot of money very quickly. How was I going to do this? And it seemed unbelievable that I could make enough money. And of course, going to a state school was not that expensive. So I only needed to make a few thousand dollars, which I did. Mm-hmm. So that's what drew me there. I knew some of the people who were already there, so it wasn't a lie. But in fact, people were doing very well financially. And I knew that I wanted to do this for several months. And that's what I did. That's how I got there.
Looking back environmentally, would you say it was ethical logging?
So what I specifically did and what the company did, it was ethical because I would never cut live trees. Mm. What we did was called cedar salvage. So we would go in and take out the trees that were preventing new growth from coming up. What we did is we cut the very long, the base of the tree, the trunk of the tree that was not used for masts for ships. Mm. So a stump might be, 12 feet high by about 20 feet long, but they didn't use that part. They just used the top. So the product was called Invincible Cedar Product. There are a lot of TM people there and meditators, which is what attracted me. So there was a group that I was already going to be with that I knew. And I felt it wasn't just a bunch of tough guys, but these were all guys like me who were trying to make money for whatever reason. Mm. So I knew that as a company, they had a lot of integrity. In fact, there was someone who actually grew up in that area, and he actually cut into the tree line, and he was absolutely forbidden not to do it, and they fired him. Mm. They said, look, we are not cutting trees. Mm-hmm. So he was fired, and we were only taking stumps that were preventing the growth from hatching. So that's why I felt very comfortable doing this.
Right. That's good. I'm reading this book called The Overstory right now. I don't know if
you're... Yes, so am I.
Oh, you are?
Yes,
no
I'm
kidding.
Reading it as well.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm like
yeah,
about...
Yeah, I love it.
I'm about 9/10 of the way into it. So
right. I'm
close.
About... where am I? I don't know. A third into it. So it's quite
fantastic. I won't spoil anything for you. Why don't you talk about, in as concise a way as you can, becoming a photographer and establishing yourself as a photographer in New York, to what extent, and maybe to help frame it a little bit, to what extent were you aware either then or now in retrospect of leaning towards traditional photography, which obviously what you were schooled in and apprenticed in, versus experimental photography versus commercial photography? Photography has become, I think, a lot more integrated into fine art in recent years. But back then, or many years ago, it was much more bifurcated, particularly with commercial photography and even traditional black and white. So, take it however you want.
So when I got to the visual studies workshop, working with Nathan Lyons, Joan Lyons, etc., Nathan, of course, was a traditional photographer. Joan was working with the book, and Nathan would talk about the relationship between the photograph and the space between the photograph. It wasn't really, that implied a book, but in his classes, we talked about exhibitions and how you make statements with the pauses. Now a pause would be, in the old days, you'd have a contact sheet, which is a 36 exposures of what you had shot. You print them on one sheet of paper and you can see all the images. But the thinking is, well, what's in between each image? So what's in between each image, how you got to the next image, is as critical, if not more important, than how you actually took that picture. So I started to explore the relationship of one image, and then what's the process? How do you get to the next image so you create a statement, a logic, or a leap of faith so the image makes sense? And that implied a book. And then with Keith Smith, I started working with the physicality of the books. And I loved the physicality of stitching the book, of learning about the relationship of pacing, turning the page, going back and forth. And I didn't have that when you had an exhibition of work, which is just one photograph next to another on the wall. So the physicality, which came from my working in construction and being a cedar salvage, we call it a cedar salvage rat, that physicality I really appreciated in working with artist books. Mm-hmm. Now, we probably don't have a lot of time to talk about the difference between what an artist book is, what a livre des artistes is, and what a book work is. But basically, the artist books are books that are paginated on one side. They, for the most part, don't really explore the structure of the book, but it's just the paginated, the imagery, et cetera. And it's a very open-ended system. Whereas what I do, which is called book work, I became very interested in not only imagery, but in terms of the structure of the book, the spine of the book, the cover, the materiality of the book. And I began to take my carpentry skills and I began to cut the books up. This happened in Rochester. So that seemed to be a route that excited me, the physicality of it. And then conceptually, I began to explore the idea of what is knowledge. And that came from my TM background as well. You know, what is knowledge? What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be part of nature? What is nature? So I began to work with natural elements. I began to freeze books in ice. I began to make paper, etc. So all these different veins started to develop. Now, after 4 years of working in photography and book work and book art and doing carpentry, when I moved to the States, I really had no idea what I was going to do, but I ended up doing carpentry more than I did photography. I wanted to keep my artwork pure. I now had a master's of fine arts, but not having any citizenship status, I had to work under the table. So for the first couple of years, I worked as a carpenter. And when I was sanding wood, I would sand the layers of wood, and then I began to apply that type of sanding to my books, thinking that basically a codex, which is a book bound on one side, and its depth of pages was really just a block of wood. It was like a block of wood. So that's how I started to grind and sand books, was from working as a carpenter. Then I had the good fortune of being an artist in residence. It was called the Dayton Hudson Artist Residency at Carleton College. And it was there that I was teaching a course in book art. There are a lot of details, but I'll just leave those out. But this was 1988-89. When I came back from Carleton College, I was there for about 6 months. I realized that I needed to do something, and I didn't want to physically always be tired working in construction. So talking to a number of my friends who were already morphed and lost their virginity as artists in freelancing and photography. And they were making tremendous amounts of money so that it would support their artwork in order to do what they love. And I had done social documentary photography as a student. I photographed circuses. So I felt primed for photographing weddings and bar mitzvahs and doing portraits. And that's how it started, that I began to realize I did not want to be poor in New York City. In 1989, before I got the job at Carleton College, I had $100 in my pocket. I thought, this sucks. I don't have any money. I don't have any status here. I don't want to go back to Canada. So how am I going to stay here? And I realized that the money was a means to support myself in order to do what I love to do, which was to do my artwork. So there was a psychological shift. I also think it was a spiritual shift as well, a deeper shift. But I realized that if I wanted to stay in the States, I had to establish myself, not only as an artist, but an outstanding artist, because I wanted to get my green card. And to do that, I had to show the immigration that I was, quote, outstanding. So when I realized that I wasn't going to just teach, because no one wanted a teacher who didn't have their status, because they wanted to give teaching positions to Americans, I had to say this was survival. So that's how I got into freelancing photography. It made me a better artist. It made me a businessman, not in the sense of Wall Street, but in the sense of I had to be very clear about what my intentions are in terms of being a photographer and dealing with people who had no patience with photographers who were flaky. And I did very well. I actually photographed for about 10 years, and I photographed some very famous people and weddings, and that's how I sustained myself.
Who did you shoot for other than for private clients for events? Did you like magazines?
Well,
or?
I always worked for myself. And again, I didn't need a green card, right? I was paying my taxes. I learned that in 1987 when I worked as a co-director of Liddell Gallery, one of the first photography galleries in Soho. And Liddell got me my work permit, so I was here legally. So when I went to Carleton College, I just used that, which was totally illegal at the time. But when I got there, they said, well, you know, no one's going to bother you. Just use the same T visa or whatever it was. And when I came back, I realized, goodness, I can't use that visa. It's going to be recalled. So that's when I ran into another Canadian friend, and he told me, he said, Doug, I just applied for what's called the extraordinary alien. And I thought, what a fool. Now you're going to be recorded on paper with immigration. If you don't get it, they're going to throw you out of the country. I see him 3 months later, and he says, Doug, I got my green card. And I was shocked. So I went to the same lawyer. I applied. And in fact, I got my green card. And that's when I felt relief. That's when I felt that I could stay here and pursue my art. So I continued to freelance. And at that time, there was a collector. His name was Alan Chasanoff. He would come into the gallery and I would meet him. I curated a show with his artwork in it. And he came in with a friend who was also the curator of his ceramics collection. His name is Raymond Aluza. Ray and I were in an exhibition together called Craft. I was showing not my photography, but my book works. So Ray said, Alan is starting a book work collection. And I said, I had no idea Alan was interested in this kind of work. I thought he was just collecting photography and ceramics. He said, no, he's interested in where books are being transformed into objects other than themselves. So I met with Alan and we expressed to each other. Alan said, I thought you were a photographer. I said, I am, but I've been doing books for about 10 years now. So he hired me as his curator of the Alan Chasanoff book work collection. And we worked from 1992, 93 until 2014. So if I didn't start off as a photographer in a gallery and as a freelance photographer, I may never have gotten to that point. So I never had to work for anybody. I was an independent consultant, per se. I put ads in the paper, people would refer me, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So some of the people that I photographed would be John Kennedy, right? John Kennedy. Mm-hmm. He was there with a friend. I'll say the name of the couple, but the man had worked for Clinton. So these were people who were very politically high up, et cetera. I mean, I enjoyed photographing anybody, not just these great individuals. So that's how it started.
Were there any takeaways from photographing quote-unquote VIPs, since that sounded like something you were doing part of that time?
Not really, because I wasn't there to photograph them as VIPs. I was there to photograph them in natural. So I got a number of pictures of John Jr. that I think are very relaxing and very direct. But to me, I didn't make a big deal of it. I was interested in photographing the moment. And that's what people hired me to do. They said, Doug, we want you to do your like your early documentary work. We want you just to be yourself, be a fly on the wall. So I didn't have to do the schlocky traditional photograph. And it just made me a better photographer, a better artist.
So wait a second.
So clarify.
So you, if you're a fly on the wall, so does that mean that they're giving you access where you can hang around, like, for the day, and then you're just shooting and getting these moments where the subject doesn't know that you're photographing them?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. For instance, there would be some women who are very comfortable with a man coming into their dressing room and they have nothing on, and I'm photographing them. Because they know me as an artist. They don't know me as a paparazzi trying to take advantage of them.
Right.
My rapport with them and my promise was you would never see your picture being sold to, I mean, it was an intimate moment. And I ended up, I think, with a couple of portfolios of just wedding work that was very, was inspiring to people. So that's how I got the job.
And when did this freelance work, as you're calling it, end? Because you're not doing that today, are you?
No. So part of the parallel stories that happened, I moved into the building that I'm now living in 1989. And Alan had bought a tremendous amount of work in 1992. And I put that money away. Then I was freelancing in photography. The building came up for sale in 1998. And I bought it. So it's a typical brownstone. It's two family. I bought it. Then 2001 happened. And I asked a family friend who was a financial advisor to my parents. And I said, if I didn't want to freelance anymore, looking from your experience, do you think that I'd be able to survive and do well? And he said, look, Doug, you're selling your book works, your sculpture. You're making money as a freelance photographer. You've got the equity in the building. And after 9/11, I realized life is long, but life is short. And it was then that I stopped in freelancing in photography. I realized that I was selling enough of my book work and making just my basic needs from rent. You know, I don't make anything from rent, but it was paying my basic needs and from the mortgage, et cetera. So I realized that my income would plummet, but now I was just doing my photography full time. So basically my book works in photography, stop motion animation, since 2001, I've been a full-time artist that time. I've done a little teaching, a number of lectures, et cetera. I've traveled all over the world because of my work. I'm invited to do these exhibitions. So I'm glad that I'm not freelancing, but I still appreciate it. It's not like I regret it. I've never had to regret it.
Right. What is this might sound a little superficial, but what are the works? Because you mentioned being a full-time artist and you mentioned selling particularly these book works, but, you know, presumably photographs as well. What particular works or objects of yours are the most lucrative for you? What helps sustain you the most, you know, financially?
Well, I've been working with JHB Gallery, Jane Baum Gallery, for many, many years. And Jane has been able to place some of my works in both private and public collections. It's hard to pick out which children I favor, but in terms of my artwork. But I would have to say the most lucrative ones. There's a collection in Belgium by this woman. She has a number of my pieces. Let's say Vest of Knowledge. So Vest of Knowledge, there are four parts to this piece. And I think each part was like, I think it was like $80,000. And then we, of course, gave her a discount and I only get 50%. But still the retail value, I think it was like $88,000. But it actually is a, let's say I appreciate this piece for its contextual nature, content as well as contextual. There's a physicality to the piece, but also it has to do with knowledge being explosive. And essentially what they are, they're suicide vests, but I call them antithetical suicide vests because the vests are made out of vinyl. They're transparent rather than opaque, which a lot of suicide people want. You can't see how they're going to transform the environment very soon into death. And yet my suicide vests are filled with life. So the content of the book, rather than dynamite and nails, it's an Encyclopedia Britannica. So that, and they look like bombs. The idea was if these were to metaphorically go off, people would become inculcated or become smarter. So it's, what I try to do is create the opposite to what the obvious is. You know, a suicide vest, who wants to make a suicide vest? We don't need them. But to make a vest that's explosive with knowledge is something that interested me, and it still does today. And when I was making these, I went back to the history of knowledge, and I had many quotes, about 100 quotes about the explosiveness of knowledge. Philosophers, writers talked about, for instance, Shakespeare said, I'm on the wings, I go to heaven with the explosiveness of knowledge or something. Knowledge is formidable and highly explosive. I forget some of the philosophers who wrote this. So that was one of the pieces that I sold, is now in a museum collection.
So this gallerist that you mentioned is selling a mixture of sculptures and photographs. Is that right?
She doesn't really sell my photography. Jane started off as selling photography. And then over the years, she began selling sculpture, photography, mixed media, and book work. Mm-hmm. So she certainly sells a lot of photography. That's what she's well known for. But she also sells other work now. And I'm in the other category of, but she sells, because my early work is more, again, journalism, social documentary, and that's not her interest. Her interest is in abstraction, basically abstraction.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And experimental photography,
right?
Whatever that might be. I mean, I'm experimenting as well. Experimental is a very, I mean, to really become experimental, it has to be something that you are so beyond the beginning of it. When people say, oh, I'm just experimenting. No. Experimenting is when you've given up everything that you know and you're on the cutting edge of something that you don't know. To me, that's what experimental photography is.
Well,
so it's a little different than...
Sure. Well, my take is going to come from a different angle, and that is that you made this transition from commercial photography and through your freelance photography to this very sculptural, you know, barely, if at all, photographic-based artworks.
Right.
And that seems pretty unusual to me. You know, and for comparison, I can think of a couple, at least, if not more, fine art photographers, you know, in other words, photographers mm-hmm. who show in fine art contexts, who also do or have done commercial work. In other words, like they've been hired to do, you know, a shoot for, you know, for some fashion brand or magazine or whatever, you know what I mean? And that, so, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So in other words, it's like there's a weird kind of contradiction or paradox in those two models.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The demand for photographers who are also not only fine art photographers, but commercial photographers, we know their works have been, their works graze on some of the great magazines because they want to support an artist, but also there's a commitment there to the visual medium that can be very explosive and beautiful and inspiring. But we also know that today, you can be a mixed media artist, you can be a musician, you can be a computer generating artist, and at the same time, you can make things. So I'm a maker of things, but also conceptually, I love the ideas behind a piece that's also visual.
Right.
So the transition was very natural. And when I was at the Visual Studies Workshop, and before I started exploring the book, exploring the photograph, and then how was I going to put the photograph together, that was a book. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to really know books, I have to learn how to put them together. And I found a private binder who also taught. So I studied with him for 2 or 3 years. And then another part of this formula is there was a teacher who taught us. He said, look, if you're going to learn to be binders, you have to know how to pull a book apart. So I began to pull books apart. And as I did that, I realized this world is like the world of science when you look through a microscope and you see all the different layers. Well, in a book, pulling a book apart, so you've got the content, which might be the photograph, And then you've got the covers, you've got the glue, the boards, the papers. And when you pull the book apart, you see the rawness of it. So all of this interested me. It wasn't just as Ulysses Carrion, the great Mexican Dutch theorist said, a book artist makes books, writers write text. So I wanted to be a book artist. I didn't just want to write text or take pictures. I wanted to make things that required my study into the depth of the book. And that meant from building the book up from nothing, which is the paper, et cetera, the spine, et cetera. So after learning how to make the books, I had so much fun pulling them apart that I didn't want to go off to become a binder, which was one of the possibilities of going off to England or Switzerland to become a traditional binder. And I'm so glad that I didn't. So that's how I got to pulling and work with books as a photographer to working with the book by itself, which started in 1979.
Yeah. Do you feel a kinship at all with other artists who work with books or have worked with books? Or is it?
Yeah, very much so.
You do?
And part of it is I'm a curator because I love looking at other people's works. I do have a career in my work, but also I have pushed many artists. I've given a number of artists to Jane, and I've curated exhibitions. I curated almost every book that's in the Alan Chazanoff Bookworks collection. And he said to me, Doug, when he was collecting photography, he said, I'm a photographer, although he would never say that he's an artist. He just said, I'm a photographer. And he said, I know photography. I know ceramics. But he said, I didn't know the medium of book work. He said, I know that you're a photographer, which is important. And that's one of the transitions from his collections, from photography to book work. And he created these transitions from each of the different collections that he had. So I was a transition from photography to books. Because he knew in 1986, he knew that the book was being challenged due to the advent of the computer. And he knew that the book was going to become obsolete. So he was looking for works in book work that was challenging the advent of the computer. Like the book is not the computer, but when do books act like they're a computer? And how is the computer going to challenge the book? If we have a book, a technology like the book that has been doing this for generations, and now we have the computer, what's going to happen to this technology that's been with us? And we know that there's a decline in the book, even though in magazines especially. So he saw this coming, and he collected from 1992, when I started working with them, to again 2014. And then that collection of 350 pieces went to the Yale Art Museum. So I really do love looking at other people's works. It gives me a great sort of sense of appreciation. So for many other book artists, we call them, that are in the field that I could name, and I loved working with them.
You mentioned your house, Brownstone, I should say, to me as a sort of a source of retirement. It will be your retirement, right? Because you'll be collecting form of income through your tenants, indefinitely. But it's hard to imagine you stopping making work, right? So are you actually ever going to retire, or is that just kind of a term for having financial solvency, through the end of your life?
Well, I do have financial solvency now. I mean, I don't go on lavish vacations. I generally travel not only to see my family in Canada, but I've traveled all over the world and invited to travel and exhibit because of my work. I like being at home. I am a homebody. I continue to make works. And as I say, as long as I have ideas, I try not to repeat myself, because if I do, I mean, what's the point? What's the point? So will I retire? It all depends on whether I feel there's a necessity. Certainly, what interests me is what Duchamp, that philosophy of why did he stop making art? Because he didn't have to anymore. He started playing chess. And in my case, it may be, certainly I'm not of that caliber, but in my case, it may be, I may not feel the need anymore because of my so-called spiritual and encapsulations, you know, how much that's going to overarch everything that I do. Both are very powerful in my life at this point. So retirement is an abstraction to me. It just means that maybe I no longer have the impetus and the ideas to continue. So I do feel secure because, again, 1989, I really had nothing. And it scared the hell out of me to think that I could be homeless. Although at the time, I don't think my parents would allow it. You know, they would loan me the money, give me the money, but they would never allow that. But I, in my head, I had to feel that independence and felt like I needed to do something to protect my art, like a child. So the child needs to be fed. And my artwork, as a, the child as artwork, still needs to be fed. So I have to protect it. And I feel that what I give to the tenants who live here, you know, they make a tremendous amount of money. The rent is not extraordinary. It's under market. But I also do Airbnb. And I feel like I'm the host and I have guests from all over the world. They're wayward travelers. And they love staying here because I feel that everybody is welcome. Truly, everybody is welcome into my house. I have no fear of someone stealing anything. So there's a level of trust from both sides. So I feel financially that I figured it out, what works for me. I'm not going to get a big Social Security payment. It might be enough to pay for a couple of weeks of food. So I had to come up with an alternative. I did want to teach full time, but that never happened for whatever reason. So I have no other means except this physical building that when I sell it, I know that I will be financially secure so that I can be taken care of if I start to drool when I'm very old.
Right. What, how does the Airbnb arrangement work? Do you have, you rent out one of your bedroom or the basement or what's the deal?
No, I have a front room and a middle room, which is my library. And one is a little larger than the other. And it's through Airbnb, which I'm very grateful to have. I still have issues with them in terms of how they vet their hosts and sometimes their guests. But basically, I believe that they're a pretty decent company. They've got some serious problems that they
so
have
you,
to
so
resolve.
So you rent out the library, as you call it, that's the room that the guests get?
Yeah, they get the library and people love sleeping between the covers. So to speak,
right?
Of the covers and the books of covers, and then the front bedroom is a little larger, etc.
Right.
So I really feel that, and I'm this innkeeper, and people come from all over the world, and they get to experience not only New York City and Brooklyn, but if they show an interest, I show them work, and it's actually been very beneficial because I had an exhibition in Wellington, New Zealand last year of my social justice piece, which is called WASH, based on the director of the Performance Arcade program, you know, and he told me what he was doing. He was coming here to do something with BAM and another art facility, and he asked to look at my work. And so I said, I can't decide on my own. This was months later, but he said he invited me to apply. And I applied, showing the piece that I wanted to show. And it was accepted, and they brought me over there. And this was just before the pandemic. So you never know, and one doesn't know how the end result is going to turn out, such as, you know, just doing Airbnb. It's about survival for me, financial survival. And yet it's infiltrated itself like the webs of many forest trees' roots, that it produced this exhibition, a premier exhibition of WASH in New Zealand. So
I would just,
I'm very open to all of
that. That's an amazing connection that you established through your Airbnb. But I would just edit that statement that you made to it's about survival to it's about thrival, maybe, because you haven't been at that place of survival since 1989, as you said.
You know, it's true, since 1989. And yet, in my head, you're only as good as your last piece. And, you know, when you ask, well, am I going to continue? I'm just in a transition right now. I feel like I'm in the survival stage of my life. I have to recreate myself. You know, I've done this piece, the wash piece, which I learned ceramics from a friend in Minneapolis. I had to learn how to make soap. I learned the CNC machine, which is a computer numerical cutter. So I'm done with that project. Now I'm trying to morph. Well, how can I use that CNC machine to transform my books now? So I'm always thinking. So I'm like in that survival mode. But what I don't have is the terrible emotional discontent of knowing that, well, how am I going to stay in the country? How am I going to survive? How am I going to make money, et cetera? That is gone. But on a deeper level is, how am I going to survive as an artist now, right? Do I have anything more to say?
Right.
I've contributed a lot within my field. You know, I'm a curator. I've been working on my books. And I feel that for me, I've accomplished a great deal. For me, whether other people feel that way is up to them. So there's still a little bit about that survival. And I think as artists, if we start to repeat ourselves, then I think we have to question whether we have anything new to say about where we're going. So I'm always trying to challenge myself in that way.
Yeah, that's good. I'm not going to put too specific a number on it. A lot of artists don't challenge themselves, or they do repeat themselves, as you well know, I'm sure. So, but I just want to say, in wrapping things up, that even as you did put it, that there is a certain amount of survival instinct in terms of, you know, not repeating yourself, staying relevant as an artist, I still think that should be put in big quotes, because there's no comparison between trying to survive as an artist in the intellectual or creative sense versus surviving for your home, let alone your life.
Tremendous. Absolutely. Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Good. I agree with you. And that's why I am so grateful every day. To have this home, to have the space that I do. And so I don't take it for granted. Absolutely don't take it for granted. But you're right. I mean, people who are homeless, and I've seen this, you know, during the pandemic, you know, yeah. People say, oh, it's awful, we have to wear masks. And I said, look, you have a roof over your head and you're healthy. Look at this, over 600,000 people that have died. You know, be grateful right. For the fact that we didn't go into that direction.
Yeah. Great place to wrap up. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I'll be in touch again soon.
Fantastic. And we're out.